Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today there's an avid appetite for the history of behind-the-scenes people who affected history. For example, witness the popularity of films such as Hidden Figures, about the female African-American mathematicians who provided some of the brainwork for the space program, or The Imitation Game, about the mathematicians that broke the German Enigma code. My guest today, British writer, journalist, and historian Giles Milton, specializes in what he calls hidden history. That's the name of his podcast series and the focus of many of his books. His latest book is about the World War II-era British Special Operations Executive, which planned and carried out acts of sabotage, trained resistant movements in the occupied countries, carried out assassinations, and designed the weapons that carried out all of those missions. Winston Churchill called them his Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. That is the title of Milton's book. Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, The Mavericks Who Plotted Hitler's Defeat. It's published by Picador. And Giles Milton joins us today here on Studio Tulsa. Giles Milton, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
What was the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare?
Well, this was a group of what's best described as maverick eccentrics, but rather brilliant ones, inventors and of genius, who were brought on board by Churchill himself at the very beginning of the war to devise a whole new way of warfare, if you like. It was accepted that Britain's army could not win against the Nazis in a head-to-head clash. So Churchill wanted to dream up more inventive ways of trying to destroy the Nazi war machine.
And where did this group have its beginning? Because it actually predates Churchill being in the government, right?
Yes. In fact, it even predates the war in the sense that it was the spring of 1939. Obviously, the international situation was incredibly tense. And a very small group of military men decided to set up a unit called, euphemistically, MIR, Military Intelligence Research. Well, the research they were doing was actually was how to fight an effective guerrilla war.
As you mentioned, this was sort of an unconventional group. What was unconventional about it?
Well, a lot of them came from normal civilian lives. I mean, one of the most creative of the six key men in this group was a chap called Cecil Clarke. Now, he was a caravan engineer. That was his business. And he designed the most extraordinary prototype caravans with all sorts of wonderful engineering in them. And he, in the days before the war, came to the attentions of Churchill and others, and they realized that actually Cecil Clarke was an out-and-out genius, and if he could produce such innovative engineering for his caravans, then if he was set to work on designing sabotage weapons, weapons for dirty warfare, then surely this out-of-the-box thinker would be able to come up with some amazingly creative explosives. And he did just that. He developed several notable weapons. One was the limpet mine. This was a magnetic mine that could be stuck onto anything made of metal, notably Nazi battleships under the waterline. You stuck one of these mines on, and it blew up and blew a hole in the ship and sank the ship. And they were used throughout the course of the war in thousands of tons of German shipping. And also, Cecil Clarke, another invention a very nasty weapon he created, was the bespoke grenade that was used to assassinate Reinhard Heydrich, Hitler's favorite, in Prague in 1942. So he was one of these sort of characters who was just able to think round problems and find solutions where no one else could.
Now, we should probably do some English-American translation. A caravan is actually like a travel trailer. We would call it a recreational vehicle. This is what he was designing before the war.
Yes, exactly. But I have to say, designing the most extraordinary models with the most extraordinary engineering. And because he'd also, like so many of the characters in my book, he'd taken part in the First World War, he'd dealt with explosives in the First World War, he was not a complete novice or amateur to this. So he came with a background knowledge of warfare and then applied his extraordinary brain to finding some very creative solutions to very big problems.
And I love the line in the book. He said he in the First World War, he liked to make big bangs.
Yes. A lot of these men, they did see a sort of devious humor in the work that they were doing. And it was very devious work. And one thing that I think is worth stressing is that These men realized that a highly militarized and highly mechanized army, such as the one that Hitler had, which, you know, steamrolled through Europe, conquering country after country, it nevertheless had its weak points. Notably, that a big mechanized army like that requires fuel, it requires supplies, and all the sort of the background logistics that goes into moving a vast army across the country. And so what they decided to do was, instead of hitting the army head on, they'd hit all those supply lines, the weak points, the bridges that the army would have to cross. And they realized that by doing that, you could very, very easily cripple an army and stop it in its tracks simply by some very carefully well-placed explosives.
Now, as this group got going, I think the first mission they undertook was to reach Poland just before the Nazis invaded Poland at the beginning of the war. Mm. And I remember your description of them leaving for the train station, and it was like they were going on a country outing.
Yes, it's extraordinary. I mean, it shows how amateur they were at the beginning of the war, that they were told not to come in military uniform. So they all dressed up in sort of their club blazers and ridiculous hats and everything. And, you know, they looked like some sort of fancy dress party going off to Poland. They were meant to be going off on an undercover mission to link up with Polish resistance. And, of course, they looked preposterous. But from those early beginnings, they very quickly learned to become a much more professional organization. And this was largely because the man that was put in charge of them, there was this extraordinary Scottish individual called Colin Gubbins, who was, I suppose he was to become the dark master of guerrilla warfare, a very, very shrewd, clever man who was absolutely determined that he would bring about the Nazis' defeat.
And he assembled a really interesting array of people around him. You begin the book with the story of Cecil Clark and then a woman who would serve in the headquarters, Joan Bright, I believe.
It's not often in a wartime story that women have incredibly important roles to play, but they did in the whole story of guerrilla warfare, sabotage, undercover work. Women were to play a vital role, and Colin Gubbins was instrumental in bringing women on board because he ended up controlling what was a vast organization of several thousand people working for these undercover missions. And the entire office staff, all the key roles, the people controlling and looking after and running these missions into occupied Europe, were all women. They were in charge of each department, was headed by a woman. And I thought this was absolutely fascinating, and particularly the story of Colin Gubbins' sort of secretary PR, Joan Bright, a very immensely vivacious, immensely clever, multilingual woman, young girl, really, who was brought on board at the very beginning. And she served him through, well, about halfway through the war, when she was then poached and ended up working directly for Winston Churchill, in fact, in the cabinet war rooms.
Now, that first mission we mentioned, going into Poland, there was one major piece of the puzzle that really won the war that came out of this, what was pretty much an absurd mission. By the time they took a circuitous route to Poland and the Nazis had invaded, they had had a few meetings, they ended up getting really scoused and drunk in Bucharest, and that was really the main accomplishment. But there was one main accomplishment out of that first mission to Poland.
Yes, absolutely fascinating. And even to this day, we don't know all the details of it. The files are either still kept behind, you know, in a locked cabinet, or they've been destroyed. We just don't know. But we do know some of the details, and that is, namely, Colin Gubbins, the head of this organization, made contact with not only with the Polish resistance, but with Polish intelligence. And when he and his men came back out of Poland and got back to Britain, they brought back with them a copy, in fact, an original Enigma machine. This is the coded machine that the Germans were using for all their secret transmissions. He brought one of these back to England, which enabled the British to crack the Enigma code, crack the code that the German Army and Navy and Air Force was using, and thereby listen in and know exactly what they were doing. It was an absolutely vital part of the intelligence in the Second World War.
Now, you mentioned the eccentricities of the members of this ministry, or actually it was referred to as Special Operations Executive. And we also now know, thanks to the movies and more recently, about the accomplishments at Bletchley Park, which is, again, another group of eccentric mathematicians working out how to decode Enigma. How frequent was this done during the war effort of these sort of people you would not expect to be involved in the war effort being involved in the war effort?
It was very frequent, and I think there was a feeling in Britain that the one thing the Nazis didn't have was creativity, that they had these vast regimented armies, but they didn't have this out-of-the-box thinking. And Churchill particularly saw this as a unique advantage for the British and was and really ran with that idea. So it wasn't just, you mentioned Bletchley Park, which was where the Enigma Code was cracked, but you've got to remember, there were country houses like Bletchley Park up and down the country that were being used all for special operations and various types of sabotage, guerrilla warfare, code breaking, all sorts of things. So there were up to maybe 40 or 50 country houses being used. And I mentioned a few of the key ones in my book. I focus on several very important ones for undercover guerrilla operations, notably Arisaig House, an old, large, rambling hunting lodge in the remote west coast of Scotland, which was turned into a guerrilla training school. In fact, it was known as the Killing School. And this is where commandos, saboteurs, and guerrillas were trained in how to kill and how to pull off a successful operation undercover in very, very dangerous circumstances. A fascinating story which hasn't really been written about at all.
Now, were there any rivalries, say, between the British commandos, which were sort of a main part of the British Army or Expeditionary Force, versus these irregulars?
There wasn't really like rivalry between the guerrilla forces and the commandos. In fact, they often worked together and they certainly shared weaponry and they shared know-how. Where there was massive rivalry and it caused almost came to breaking point was that this guerrilla outfit was absolutely detested by the regular army, by Bomber Command, which was the Royal Air Force headquarters, and by the British establishment in general. They thought that these men were not playing by the rules. They had a very old-fashioned view about war, that there was a code of conduct when you fought a war. You fought like British gentlemen. You know, war was a bit like a game of cricket, apart from the fact you had machine guns. And so they detested this band of what they referred to them as the pirates or the left wing. They thought they were dangerous and destabilizing, and they did everything they could to have these various units shut down. And it was really only thanks to Churchill and the personal support and financial backing that he gave to these people that they were able to continue their work throughout the course of the war.
This was actually the subject of Parliament debate, right?
Absolutely. At the beginning of the war, there was this really, when you read it now, it just comes across as completely crazy, this idea, very much this idea that war was like cricket, you know, and we fought it like gentlemen, and you could do this and you couldn't do that. Now, what Colin Gubbins, aided by Churchill, felt that in a war against the Nazis had already torn up the rule book. So if they were fighting dirty, then the only way to defeat them was to fight an even dirtier war. And this is why, as you say, my book talks about the Special Operations Executive, but it also talks about this unit called MD1, Ministry of Defense 1. This was an organization that was there to design bespoke weaponry, dirty explosives that were to be used by the saboteurs being dropped behind enemy lines.
My guest today is Giles Milton, a writer and journalist. He's the author of numerous nonfiction books as well as some novels. His latest book is Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, about special operations during World War II. You talked about bespoke weapons, and the men we mentioned earlier, Cecil Clark, was an expert at this. You mentioned the limpet mines, where you could put a mine anywhere underwater. It would be magnetic. And he had this wonderful ingenuity. Can you talk about the beginnings of the limpet mine and what they actually used as a timing charge?
Yes. Well, Cecil Clark, he realized very early on that you could make weapons, explosive weapons, out of almost anything. And this limpet mine, in its early stages, was made out of a metal bowl that he just bought from a local shop, a few magnets, and then it would be laced with or filled with explosive, which would make it go off. But any bomb, of course, needs a detonator. And if it was going to be a bomb that was used underwater, it needed a detonator that would work underwater and that would explode with absolute regularity. You had to know, if you were a diver slapping this onto the underside of a battleship, you had to know it wasn't going to blow up while you were still in the vicinity. And so it needed to be a timed detonator. And what they discovered, Clark and another gentleman who was working with him, his children were very fond of aniseed balls, these sweets you roll around on your tongue. And they realized, as they rolled these around on their tongue, that they dissolved with absolute regularity. And so the aniseed ball became the timing mechanism for the detonator of the limpet mine. Sounds completely crazy, but it worked to perfection because it always dissolved in a set number of minutes. And so they were blowing up, you know, battleships, they were blowing up power stations, they were blowing up turbines, anything that was made of metal, they were blowing up with limpet mines where the detonator inside was simply an aniseed ball.
A piece of candy.
Exactly, yes.
Now, you mentioned dirty bespoke weapons, and this is perhaps one of the most controversial parts of the book, the assassination of Reinhard Heinrich, a man who was at the WANSI conference, the one that devised the final solution. He was second in charge, I believe, in Czechoslovakia, or that part of what was then.
In fact, he was the man in charge.
Yeah, he was.
And he was also Hitler's favorite. I mean, he was known as the Butcher of Prague, a really evil individual. In fact, you know, some of your listeners might have seen the film Anthropoid, which came out recently, and that film is about the assassination of Heydrich. Mm-hmm. But of course, what the film doesn't touch on at all is what was, for me, the most interesting bit of all, which was how it was planned, how it was executed, and how the weaponry was built, and the men were trained.
And Cecil Clark designed the bespoke grenade.
Yeah, because there was a problem with killing Heydrich, because Heydrich traveled everywhere in an armor-plated Mercedes, and an armor-plated Mercedes is not an easy car to blow up. So they studied the route that he took. He used to drive into Prague every morning, and they studied the route that he took, and they realized there was one point where he reached a very steep bend where the Mercedes would have to slow down to almost a walking pace. So they realized that this was the pace to strike. Then they needed a weapon that would blow a hole through an armor-plated Mercedes, and this is where Clark came in. He modified an anti-tank grenade, which you couldn't throw an anti-tank grenade. It was huge and it was very heavy. But what he did, he reduced it in size. He packed much more explosive into it, into a much smaller, much more sort of confined space of weapon. And it was after numerous trials, it was discovered that what this weapon would do, if it was thrown correctly, it would explode underneath the car. That was the idea. And it would, the force of the explosion would simply shatter or punch a hole through the back of the car and send fragments of shrapnel and all sorts of nasty bits from the car inside Heydrich's body. That was the idea. And that is exactly what happened, even though the two assassins slightly misaimed when they threw this thing. It nevertheless did exactly what Clark intended. It exploded under the car, ripped through the armor plating. And what actually, Heydrich died about 3 days later, and he died of septicemia, which was caused by the shrapnel that had been forced into his body.
And the controversial part of this, I mean, this was war, nearly all the rules were off, but there was talk that there might have been a biological element in this bespoke grenade.
Yeah. There are references to the fact that Cecil Clark, who was known to be very interested in biological warfare, was said to have been in contact with Porton Laboratories. Now, Porton Laboratories in England at the time was where chemical warfare and biological warfare was being developed. Churchill, of course, was a great fan of biological warfare. He thought it was the future of warfare. Mm. And it's said that the chief scientist at Porton claimed that, as he put it, that the death of Heydrich, the assassination of Heydrich, was the first notch on my pistol. And he suggested that he had lent or given some biological agent to Clark to include in his weapon. And it is possible, because of the fact that Heydrich died of septicemia, that this might, it could have been caused, of course, by the shrapnel, but it could also be caused by botulism or some sort of bacillus that had been put into this grenade to make it even more deadly. Things like that, I think we'll never get to the bottom of it, but there's certainly considerable evidence to suggest that this bomb had more in it than just explosive.
Well, certainly the assassination of Heydrich really changed his outlook because it actually, I mean, he committed some atrocities in the wake of the assassination against the Czech people, and it certainly changed the structure of the SS as well. But what were the critical missions? There were a number of critical missions that this group actually pulled off. the Nazis were trying to develop an atomic bomb, and so there were missions against the heavy water facilities in Norway.
Yeah, I think that, for me, that was probably the most important mission that was carried out probably in the entire war, was to destroy this factory that was in Norway that was producing heavy water. And now heavy water was something that Hitler had to have if he was ever going to get his hands on an atomic bomb. So from the very outset of the war, it was realized that this heavy water plant posed a significant threat to the Allies. You know, the last thing they wanted was Hitler to be developing an atomic bomb. And so there were numerous attempts made to destroy this factory by air, bombing it from the air. Well, that failed. And then they sent in British commandos in a disastrous raid where they were all captured, tortured, and then executed. And in the end, Colin Gubbins, my main man, was put in charge of a mission to send in seven men under the cover of darkness to send them into the factory, break into it, blow it apart, and then get out again. It was little short of a suicide mission because the Norsk Hydro heavy water plant sat atop a pinnacle of rock, rather like a medieval castle. It was surrounded by Gestapo guards, it was, you know, guard dogs, everything, searchlights, minefields, everything. Nevertheless, these men were so highly trained and so well briefed on their mission that extraordinarily they dropped in by parachute, they managed to break into the factory under the cover of darkness, they managed to blow up everything, that all the main equipment in this factory was blown to shreds, and then they got out and escaped and got back to England alive. It was really one of the greatest sabotage coups of the entire war, I think.
There was another mission that was really interesting because there was an attempt to destroy the dry docks at Saint-Nazaire, which was also a major port that the Nazis captured in France. And there was an effort made to blow up these huge gates that controlled the entry into the dry dock, and a ship was crashed into it, but all the men were killed and captured. And then one of the highest-ranking survivors of this mission is being interrogated, and they said, "What, do you think you could break through the gates?" And he was waiting for the detonation to occur. When it was supposed to occur, it didn't occur. And literally, while they're interrogating him, the explosion happens.
With absolutely devastating consequences, against the Germans. It might sound rather boring to attack a dry dock. It doesn't sound very exciting mission. But it should be pointed out that the Saint-Nazaire docks were the largest dry dock in Europe, and they're the only dry dock in which Hitler could repair his biggest battleship, the Tirpitz, which posed a massive threat to the naval convoys that, of course, were taking place between America and Britain at the time. So the British had to stop the Tirpitz being deployed in the Atlantic, and they realized that if they knocked out the only dock capable of servicing the Tirpitz, then Hitler would not be able to deploy it in the Atlantic. And this is a brilliant example of lateral thinking. Instead of trying to sink the Tirpitz itself, which was almost impossible because it always had an armed escort going everywhere, and the solution was to just destroy the dock instead. And it was knocked out not only for the rest of the war, but for many years after the war, in fact. Mm.
Some of these secret laboratories that this ministry had, as it was referred to, had sort of the beginnings of the inspiration for James Bond and his Q. They were making really unusual weapons. What were some of the most unusual weapons these men developed?
Well, one of the early ones was the sticky bomb. The sticky bomb was a peculiar sort of hand-thrown grenade, which was covered in a really sticky, glue-like substance. At the beginning of the war, the British had no bomb or no weapon that was easily able to knock out a German tank. Things would blow up and they'd bounce off the German tanks, which were very heavily armored. And one of the men in my book developed this sticky bomb, which basically, you threw it, it stuck to the tank before it exploded. And so the entire force of the explosion was then shattered into the tank, a very effective weapon. And it meant that an infantryman on a field of battle almost became the equal of a tank, which was a big change in warfare. One of the other developments, which was more a sort of scientific development, but was absolutely fascinating, was this development called the hollow charge. If you think of a bullet, it's pointed at the front, and it will drive through anything. But it was realized that if you, inside that bullet or that shell, you inverted the charge, that you could harness the full force of the explosion backwards and then forced it forwards. And this created a far, far stronger explosion. And this was to become very, very important later in the war, because the Mavericks and Eccentrics working on this were able to produce weapons that very, very easily pierced metal, even metal that was 1 to 3 inches thick. These shells, with this amazing impact when they exploded, was able to drive through them. And this, of course, was then taken to America, this discovery, and it was used on the plutonium bomb that was dropped on Japan. The second bomb that was dropped on Japan had to have a very different triggering mechanism, because a plutonium bomb works in a very different way from a uranium bomb. And the Americans, with the British, used a hollow charge to detonate the plutonium bomb that was used in Japan.
Of course, these men are active all the way through the war, but once the war was over, this unit completely disbanded.
Yeah, it's a pretty tragic end to the tale, actually. This amazing creativity and sheer inventiveness of what they were doing simply came to an end as soon as the war came to an end. And this was partly because Winston Churchill lost the election in 1945. If he'd won, he almost certainly would have kept this thing up and running, because he saw it as valuable for the future. But the new Labour government disagreed. It was disbanded and all the men had to go and find other work. Yeah. It should be said, because it's a very interesting American postscript, that at the same time the Special Operations Executive was running in England, the Americans, of course, had set up the Office of Strategic Services. And this, at the end of the war, was not shut down. You Americans were a lot wiser. You kept it going. You gave it even more finance, and you changed its name to the CIA. Yeah. So not many people know that the origins of the CIA actually come out of a small little sabotage unit that was set up in London in the spring of 1939.
I know, the story of Bletchley Park was kept secret for a long, long time. How long was this story of this special operations executive kept secret?
Some of that was written about within sort of 10 or 20 years of the war being over, but a lot of it wasn't. And in particular, this spin-off organization, Ministry of Defense One, this was the organization that was developing all these hideous, ghastly weapons, which was working in tandem with Colin Gubbins at all times. This has never really been written about before. And a number of the key members of the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, which incidentally was Churchill's own title, that's how he referred to it, has never been written about before. And what I did is I traced the families of the six key individuals in the book, and I discovered that they had the most extraordinary personal archives in their houses, which became an important part of the book. For instance, Clark, the caravan, my caravan man, I found his very elderly relative of his, who said to me on the phone, she said, "I have an entire spare bedroom full of documents. You should come down and visit me," which I did. And of course, there she had letters from Churchill. She had an extraordinary wealth of documentation. So a lot of the book has been based on stuff that really no one's really seen before.
Giles Milton, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
British historian Giles Milton speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, The Mavericks Who Plotted Hitler's Defeat. It's published by Picador. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.